This podcast is brought to you by iGel. iGel offers the next generation edge operating system designed for simple, secure, and high performance access to virtual desktops and cloud workspaces. Easy to implement and straightforward to operate.
At the third stroke, it will be.
Hello, beautiful people, and welcome to the EUC Digest, your bi-weekly audio snack on everything EUC related. In today's show, we'll be talking about the new normal for employees and organizations, as these are unprecedented times, as you've probably heard in every podcast, virtual conference, and in analyst reports. But before we dive into this new normal, please allow us to introduce ourselves. My name is Ingmar Verheij. I'm your host for this episode, and with me today is Johan van Amersfoort. Hey, Johan, what's up? And how's your new normal?
Well, I would say everything besides normal. It's full-on virtual conference time, and VMworld is just out next week. I got 7 sessions in, and we got a lot of really awesome stuff happening. So it's seriously busy at the moment. How about yourself?
Same here. Yeah, luckily I don't have to present at conferences, but I'm attending at least 2 every week. Still adapting to this new normal of virtual conferences with the scroll syndrome, where I'm easily distracted. But it's interesting to see follow up Microsoft Ignite this week, VMworld next week, and then we've got some others coming up. So looking forward to seeing your sessions. Before we introduce our guest for today, did you find out any interesting facts about our guest?
Oh man, I found some seriously interesting facts, to be honest. Did you know that he's like an amateur phenologist and frequently shares wine tips on Facebook?
Huh.
And also, he enjoys spending time with his family and friends on his jet ski.
Wow.
He knows a couple of words, Dutch words, which involves flies and warm wine.
Interesting.
And I like this the best one. I saw that stuff, that clip. He was once asked by a Formula One driver to shut up, please.
Wow. Well, if you still don't know where our guest is, can you please tell us who you are?
Hi, guys. It's Christian Riley. Great to be with you. And yes, you're right, Johan. Everything you said, including being told to shut up by Max Verstappen, which was the highlight of my career.
All right. Well, Christian, thank you for being on our show today. So, obviously, we did some research on who's Christian Riley. And interestingly, you've got a Twitter profile, which is very convenient because it says it all. It says you're a former VP and CTO at Citrix and Bechtel. And I guess that for the most people listening today, that's how we know you. You are a VP or CTO at Citrix or Bechtel. But your profile actually continues and says you're an Imagineer, a status quo challenger, a connector of dots. And I guess for those who had the pleasure of working with you or just read your tweets, that seems very appropriate. And in fact, the reason we wanted you on the show today. But before we get into that, you really went above and beyond in your Twitter profile. You say you add Disco, Fun Seeker, Man City, which I guess is Manchester City, Grapper CC, which I assume is the Grappenhall Cricket Club in Warrington. And last, Aston Martin Red Bull Racing. Obviously home of the legendary Formula One driver, Max Verstappen. Well, who told you to shut up? What happened there? What's the story with Max Verstappen telling you to shut up?
Well, first of all, you guys are in the wrong job. You should be detectives if you've got managed to figure out all that from the Twitter profile. Where to start with Max? So we were actually in the same hotel and we were in Singapore. And the funny thing about Singapore is that it's a night race, of course. So everybody kind of works different, really weird hours. So you don't really start anything until the evening. And so we were doing a session with some of the customers. So typically at the race weekend, there's a bunch of CIOs and senior people from different customers. I'd gotten to know Max, just sort of say hi to and engage with, because we'd obviously seen him a bunch of times at different races and different events that we'd done. And he's just a super cool guy. And, he wanted to sort of just come and talk to our customers, which is part of what we do. But he wanted to do it in such a way where he kind of interrupted my presentation. And he just walked in and he said, "Christian, please shut up. I can hear you from upstairs." And that was it. And so, then he sat around and talked to the customers about Formula One and his preparations for the race weekend. And, the thing about Max is I would, suggest that he's one of those kinds of guys who is a bit like Daniel Ricciardo, Lando Norris. You see these guys are just having so much fun in what they do. But as soon as he's in the car and as soon as he puts that helmet on, man, is he a different animal. Unbelievable.
Yeah. That's passion. I mean, and it's great to hear this. I mean, just like us, he's just human. Even though, you know, when it's him in a car, I it's like, is he a robot or?
You know, I mean, I think he's just one of those people who is a 1,000,000% committed to what he does. And you know, I mean, got to remember, these guys are, you know, they're not normal, right? You think about what they do and what they put the bodies through, but you know, they literally are. The car and the person, you know, the driver, are kind of the same thing, right? They know every single thing. They can, you know, go over a bump or hit a part of the track and tell you a million things about how the setup of the car is wrong. And I mean, it was such a privilege to be involved with some of that stuff. It's fascinating. But, you know, the thing about Max is you can tell that he's Dutch, right? Because he has absolutely no filter when you see him get interviewed. So you can tell he's definitely come from the same land as you guys.
Yeah. Well, we've worked together, so I guess it's not entirely unfamiliar. It's good to hear. All right. So the topic for today, we choose the topic of the new normal, which in itself is, you know, debatable. But more on that later. I mean, we heard in numerous news articles, webinars, conferences, analyst reports. These are unprecedented times. Obviously, COVID-19, the pandemic, you know, it changed everything. So I was reading the Gartner 2020 hype cycle for digital workspaces. And they said, and I'm paraphrasing here, obviously, that decades later, we'll look back and see the pandemic as an inflection point in human development, where we ended the post-industrial age and commenced the true digital age. So Christian, what is this new normal?
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I don't know that I really subscribe to the new normal, and I'll tell you why I say that. I think everything is constantly in a state of evolution. So I think if you try and put something in the time box, you know, and try and genericize it, it's very hard to do because even within every industry, every organization is, you know, recovering and coming out of COVID. Well, hopefully, I mean, organizations that stay around, we've seen some horror stories of job losses and, you know, organizations not making it. But, you know, I think putting something around something as complex as this to say, oh, this is the new normal and it'll all look like this, I think is a fallacy. I think what we'll see is that different organizations come through this and reinvent themselves and reinvent their supply chains and their customer engagements in ways that we haven't even imagined. And so I think this notion of, you know, at some point, everybody's going to declare the new normal begins on the 15th of October, 2022. It's not going to happen that way, guys, as you know. And if, you know, history would tell us that all these evolutions that occur, you know, occur at different rates in different companies. And so, you know, I struggle with, I mean, I get the context, but I struggle with the box and trying to put everything in a box. And I think, you know, I think it's a great comment, by the way, Ingmar, that the one that you said there from the Gartner. It's highly likely, I think, that, you know, digitization, and you know, it's interesting now that nobody's talking about digital transformation anymore, right? Everybody's talking about, oh my God, how do I actually make this business sustainable going forward, using technology to help drive that. So I'm actually glad in some respects that people have stopped talking about digital transformation and actually doing it. So much, you know, but look, I mean, is it going to be a combination of automation, you know, AI, RPA, analytics? Absolutely. I mean, you know, the very notion that some of the jobs that humans did before can be done now more efficiently, more effectively. Yeah, absolutely. And is this a tipping point for that? I would imagine so. Doesn't mean that, again, we get into this argument of there's going to be, you know, less people employed. That's nothing to do with the technology. I think that's to do with the displacement of jobs for various reasons coming out of the back of COVID. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting times for sure, but I think technology is going to play a bigger and bigger part in this, you know, and has proven so over the work from home during the pandemic. You know, no, everybody said, oh, we'll never be able to do it. You know, the technology won't stand it. And yet here we are, you know, all connected by video conferences, all connected by audio, and looks like everything else just kind of worked fine.
Cool. Wow. Yeah. So, Christian, obviously, I guess it makes a lot of sense what you just said. And actually, a couple of the things you mentioned along the way, we prepared some questions on that for you, because I think there's more to it than what you just said. But before we dive into all this, let's say, change for our organizations, what is your new normal? How do you spend your days today? I mean, obviously, we talked about your history as you know, VP at Bechtel and then Citrix. How do you spend your normal days these days?
Yeah, well, as you answered, I think it's anything but normal. You know, it's well, first and foremost, you know, obviously, I you guys all know that I left Citrix in end of May of this year, which was a kind of a strange thing to do during the pandemic. But you know, I'd had a fantastic 5 years, and you know, such a great company and great people, obviously yourself included, Ingmar, and great community. And you know, it was a heck of a lot of fun. Just, I think you get to a certain point where you know, you say, I think I've taken something as far as I can personally, you know, and I wanted to go off and do different things and get some different experiences. You know, I'd been at Bechtel for a very long time and then had the opportunity to go to Citrix and do some good things there. But, you know, it was one of those things where I sort of said, you know, I want to do something differently to help grow me professionally. You know, I think I'd gotten to the point where I was very comfortable in what I was doing, and I don't like that. Nothing to do with Citrix or anything. I just the way that my mind works. And so I had an opportunity to do a couple of things with smaller companies, which has been fantastic. You know, the one thing I haven't done in my career is anything to do with startup or early stage, and I'd really always wanted to do that. So my days at the moment are really spent trying to figure out how to work with a couple of smaller companies and you know, take some of the big company learnings over the last 25 years and apply them to the startup world. It's been very interesting, actually. You know, obviously having never experienced it really before, it's amazing how many jobs you have when you don't really have a job. So you know, you're doing all sorts of different things in startups, you know, and it's exciting, you know. But my days are, you know, it can be anything from product strategy to technology leadership to business strategy to, you know, trying to figure out which way's north for where we want to go. So yeah, I mean, it's a lot of fun, and where it ends, who knows?
Yeah, exactly. It's good to hear that. I mean, obviously, roles are not so well defined as in an enterprise and a startup. That makes sense that, you know, roles are fluid. But also pushing yourself out of your comfort zone, I guess that got you where you are today, by, you know, not accepting that it's easy, or not accepting the easy role, but trying to push the boundary. Is that about right, that you try to push yourself in the, let's say, less comfortable situation?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, I've been very fortunate over the 25 years or a little bit more that I've been in IT in the bigger sense. You know, I had some wonderful opportunities at Bechtel to work all over the world and you know, take different roles. And if I think about my time there, I actually had pretty much four different 5-year careers over the 20 years I was there. You know, learned a ton of things there. And then, you know, obviously the 5 years I had at Citrix, you know, I started off in one position and ended up in the global CTO role. I don't know whether that was by design or more by just the way that things played out. But again, you know, it was fantastic to get the opportunities there. And you know, you do push yourself out of the comfort zone. I mean, you know, it's second nature to me to want to engage in the customer space because I spent such a long time in it. But you know, I think when you get comfortable with something and you know, you kind of feel like personally you're not growing or you're not challenging yourself as much as you could, then I generally think it's always time to do something different. And so, you know, I wouldn't say it was a mantra of mine. And you know, I would say that I don't like being in a scenario where I don't feel like I can, you know, be challenged or make a difference. And I think in any organization, any company around the world, there's a certain point of time where, you know, you kind of reach and you get familiar enough to say, you know, do I want to carry on doing this or do I want to go learn something new? And, you know, when I think back on it, 25 years, it's gone in a heartbeat. You know, this is a short life and a short career, you know, and I'm 47 now, so I've probably got 10 years of energy left before I just end up washed up on a beach somewhere. So, you know, I think you got to pick and choose wisely on what you do. And this was one thing I wanted to do, you know, and hopefully we'll make a success of these things. And, you know, it'll be a great learning along the way, whatever happens.
So, yeah, well, I mean, I envy you for being so brave on I mean, taking the step. Obviously, you said, you know, you're 47, and there's a whole life ahead of you. And with the energy you have and passion, and, you know, I can imagine you have way more than just 10 years ahead of you. But yeah, I mean, it takes guts to say, like, hey, you know, I'm in a very comfortable situation. I've got, you know, I got a good role within an enterprise solution or enterprise organization. Let's just leave all the everything behind during a pandemic and say, you know what, I'm chasing my passion, or I'm chasing a new career or a new.
I think that mainly has to do with the fact I have the same thing. I've changed careers for a couple of times and roles within different companies. And especially when I'm looking at my current employer, ITQ, I had three roles in the past 7 years. But that's just due to the fact that I thrive by change. I love to change and to get the I don't know to find out how to grow as a person in the things that you do. And I reckon that you do the same, right? You thrive by change.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I, several years ago, somebody, and it's the first time I'd actually ever heard the phrase, but somebody who was a very close mentor of mine actually described me in a meeting with some very senior people as a change agent. And I'd never heard the phrase before. This is probably a decade ago. And I thought, actually, that's really interesting. And then, and I mentally promised myself to commit the rest of my career to being, you know, someone who would go and look at things in a different way and challenge status quo and you know, ask the five whys. You know, why are we doing this? Why are we doing it? Why are we doing it? Why can we do something different? No, I think you're right. I mean, the change is a big part, but you know, there's also another element, and I'm sure you guys see it too. You know, whether you recognize it or not, you know, we learn so much, and as we get older, you know, we kind of have a different view on things. And you know, to your point, Imar, about you know, changing it, maybe the top of the game, if you like. I mean, it's a very privileged position to be in a CTO role in a company like Citrix. But I also felt that, you know, part of me wants to give back, right? So, you know, going into a company or companies where there are younger people with less experience, you know, I'm as excited by helping people develop. And I've kind of always been that way because it was kind of how my career played out. You know, I was extremely lucky to have people who believed in my abilities and would give me the challenges. And I think, you know, as you get a little bit older, certainly for me, my goal was more around making sure that my experience doesn't just, you know, fade away with my retirement in 10 years time or whatever it is. So that's always been a big thing for me and the opportunity to do that, you know, and it was great in Citrix because a lot of people used to stop me in the corridors and say, hey, you know, it's a great presentation or it's great to hear your opinion or whatever. And it's like, yeah, but we need more of that as an industry. We need more of that, especially in, you know, diversity and inclusion where, I mean, I was actually looking at Duncan Epping's thing this morning on Twitter, actually, when he talked about what he's been doing for getting Chromebooks for disadvantaged kids in Vietnam. And I'm like, this is fabulous. You know, we just need so much more of this stuff. So I think, Ingmar, the point I'm trying to make is as you get through this stuff and you have lots of opportunities, I think it becomes less about wanting always to be, you know, have the role or have the you know, the title or whatever else. You want to make the impact. You want to challenge yourself. And above all else, for me at the moment, it's like, how can I give back? You know, this uh-huh. industry has given me a lot. And I, you know, I think we have a moral obligation to kind of give back.
Yeah. And I think that's great. I mean, and how privileged are those people that they, you know, that you can mentor them or guide them in their career? At least that's my opinion, that having worked with you, I mean, those people are privileged.
Well, I think you and I had some similar conversations, right? You know, back in the day about you know how we might do things and do them differently. It's kind of hard when you don't, you know, have people that work for you directly. I mean, it's kind of hard to do that, and I don't know if it's privileged or not. But you know, I mean, I think look. My intentions with developing people are always to try and get the best out of people, to stretch them and to get them to think differently. You know, and every opportunity that you get to do that, I think is a fantastic one. And again, you know, we talk about this word privilege a lot, but you know, I got so many opportunities to do so many things, you know, and now as you guys know, the technology over time becomes second nature. You know, it's all okay. There's always new stuff. But I explained it a couple of weeks ago, actually, about, you know, when we look at technology and what's actually happening, so much of it is derived from something else that, you know, it's not like we're coming up with brand new things that you say, oh, wow, this is like something I can't even wrap my mind around. It's like being a car mechanic, right? I said to somebody the other day, once you understand how an internal combustion engine works, you can pretty much work on any type of car if you understand the basics. So, you know, I think if I think about my background in, you know, infrastructure and networking and then systems architecture and then running development teams and then running the business. you know, I got so much experience to be that mechanic. And, you know, it's, or if you want to think about it like a conductor of an orchestra, right? You don't have to know how to play every single instrument, but you know how it's supposed to sound when you put them all together. So, you know, I think as you, you know, as we sort of see all the things, you know, whether it's Kubernetes technology or cloud native apps, it's like, this is all great, but it's things that you can assimilate because it's kind of all variations on the theme.
Well, I think this is a great segue into you know the technology bit. I think you have a passion for technology like we have, and as this is a technical podcast, I'd like to dive into some technology if that's okay with you. First, in some call VDI or DAS like traditional technology you know, we've seen that when offices close and people start to work from home more frequently, it led into a peak in VDI and DAS consumption in an area well understood by our listeners. Do you think this is the future or just a stopgap solution?
Well, I mean, that's a great question, Johan. I mean, you know, is the desktop a future in and of itself? I mean, you know, I said this when I was at Citrix a couple of times. You know, the way I view a desktop, it's a complicated container for applications, right? So if you really think about like what I'm trying to say there, you know, the only reason you need a desktop is for applications. There's no other reason to have a desktop at all. And so I think there's always a scenario where you're going to have applications that require some form of desktop to be, you know, a convenient container for them to launch. But you're also going to have, as we saw within Citrix, within the workspace and the evolution of that, tons and tons of applications that don't require a desktop in the traditional sense, right? So I think if you look at a traditional enterprise footprint, you know, even now, I don't think enterprises have reached the tipping point of having more non-desktop required apps than desktop required. So I think if you look at it at the moment, from a future perspective, I would say, from the point of view of enabling the things that you know VDI and DAS has done, and you can see that evidently from you know the work that Microsoft are doing and continuing to do with Citrix on WVD and Citrix Managed Desktop or whatever it's now called. I think it was renamed fairly recently. I'm sure Ingmar will know. So I think if you look at that from a, will it be a future trend in the way that organizations adopt it? Highly probable from the point of view of, look, we're not in the office anymore. You know, I think the stuff that was done with remote PC was actually really cool and very timely. But I think, you know, as organizations look at that and say, well, you know, if I'm going to shut this office down, there's no point me keeping all the desktops where they were. So that's a natural evolution of those things to go into cloud. So yeah, I mean, it depends, I think, on how you look at future. I mean, you know, is the future of application delivery a desktop? I don't think so, based on what we see, you know, around mobility and web and, you know, applications that are, I would say, perhaps architected differently and presented differently. But is there a long tail of VDI? Yeah, I definitely think so, from the point of view of the fact that, you know, every enterprise has got hundreds and hundreds of traditional apps and new apps that they're dealing with. And it's very convenient to wrap them you know, in a desktop for the most part. And then from our, you know, from ours, yours perspective, you know, wrap some kind of workspace around it, which allows you to do, you know, the desktop side and the non-desktop side. It seems perfectly logical to me and hopefully as a response to, you know, the agility that's going to be required as organizations rethink what their next normal is rather than the new normal.
Now, and this is a great answer, but now what about the non-enterprise side of things? So I believe you are the founder of running a VDI simulator on VDI, an F1 simulator on VDI. And I stole your idea, did the same with a different solution from a different vendor. But that was like a couple of years ago already. And now we're seeing that big companies like NVIDIA, Google, and Microsoft are doing the same. What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, so let me give you the background on that. That was actually, that started life as a thing that we called V2R, which was virtualized virtual reality. And what I was trying to do back then was prove a point of being able to use virtualization. And again, we'll stay vendor agnostic, but of course, the company I worked for at the time had a pretty good solution for 3D. And so what I was trying to do was push the boundaries of what we had. And the primary reason for it was I was fascinated by where virtual reality was going. But at the time, there was a scenario where you had to have the VR headset tethered to a desktop with an HDMI cable, which is not great for trying to walk around unless you want to carry the desktop with you or have a giant HDMI cable. And if you remember, you know, most VR at the time, you have to do like a calibration where you have to set out a certain area and you kind of have the calibration. So I challenged some of the guys in the Cambridge office in the UK to come up with something that was basically like a tool belt that had an Intel NUC and it you know, had a version of the Citrix receiver back then, which used HDX 3D Pro, and it actually ran a Windows 10 VDI session using Citrix Zen Server at the time and a bunch of NVIDIA GPU. And I was trying to find out how to not make people sick, right? And everybody looked at me, like, what are you talking about? I said, because the problem with VR is if you get past, or if you get below a certain frame rate, it really, really is a terrible experience and you get kind of a little bit disoriented and whatever. And so that's where the original one started. And then, of course, when we got a little bit more familiar with the guys at Red Bull and we found the Playseat, which I think is a Dutch company as well, if I remember rightly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we got the first Playseat and then, you know, it was like, oh, let's stick it in one of our briefing centers, but let's put it on an Xbox or a PlayStation. And I was like, no, let's not do that. Let's actually run the Windows version of the Codemasters F1 game, but let's do it in the same way that I did VR, because obviously, as you know, Johan, when you sit in front of it, even if it's multi-monitor, you know, you've got to have that smooth scrolling. Otherwise, it just like it plays with your mind, right? Because you know the way that your eyes assimilate and try and process doesn't work with the way that you're used to seeing things in the real world. So yeah, that was the intention of that, and then we built one for Max actually, and Daniel Ricciardo. They had one in the what they call the mezzanine, which is in the factory, the Red Bull factory in the UK. And so, you know, you would go in there sometimes for customer events and Max would be happily driving it with the, you know, Citrix logos on it. And it was doing exactly what you said. So, yeah, I mean, that was the genesis of that. But we were just trying to push the technology, really. I mean, we were trying to get the maximum frame rate we could get out of HDX at the time. And, you know, just kind of push the boundaries on things because, you know, as part of the research we were doing then, and again, it was nothing to do with COVID, but I had a vision at one point that we would do virtual meetings and maybe through VR and whatever. And I know, you know, VMware have done a lot of work in that space as well. And I think, you know, Apple in the next couple of years are going to surprise everybody. I think there's some awesome AR and VR stuff just bubbling along at Apple that's going to be absolutely phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. I think, I mean, it's great to hear that you're, I mean, again, pushing the boundaries, you know, challenging status quo, basically, with VR, but also in remote meetings. I guess I'm really looking forward to the day where I don't need a physical desktop or physical screen on my desk. I just have, you know, okay, acceptable VR, Google, or mixed reality, augmented reality, whatever you're going to call it, or whatever technology is going to thrive here. I mean, seeing the announcement from Microsoft this week, they are trying to push the boundary as well at their pace, as is Facebook doing. I entirely agree. Whenever Apple comes to market, it's probably going to be good. Maybe they're late, but it's probably going to be good and not sparking a conversation on Android versus Apple. But I think that's going to be the new normal. But also, I mean, as a segue into let's say the new normal. Speaking on Twitter, I keep hearing you say like there's a difference between working from home and working remote. Obviously, you know, if you have goggles and you have your office on the go, that makes sense. But why is it important to you to be explicit on the difference between working from home and working remote?
Yeah, so, well, again, maybe just to give you the background on that one, guys, to make sure it makes sense in the context. So first of all, this was as a response to some of the things that we'd seen from Citrix customers when sort of COVID first happened. And my observation, by the way, guys, and this is an interesting soundbite, but if you think about the speed at which essentially many countries in the world fully shut down, right? I mean, you know, when you're in enterprise IT in a big company like I was in Bechtel, you do a lot of disaster recovery planning, a lot of business continuity planning is just part of what you do. You know, and then we would run simulations of, hey, you know, the data center in Houston or the one in Hong Kong or wherever has gone offline, you know, it's blown up. We need to you know, enact the DR procedure and the business continuity piece. The reality is that in my 20 years at Bechtel and being involved with a lot of those drills, we never ran a scenario where every office in the world went offline within the space of a couple of weeks. And so my point was, and again, a little bit, as I mentioned earlier, you know, there was a suggestion when this happened that, you know, the underlying networks or the scale of a Zoom or a Teams or a WebEx or a GoToMeeting or whatever would not be able to cope with the demand. And we saw that, you know, from schools taking it up and colleges and businesses and whatever, you know, that was a pretty amazing thing in and of itself. But my comment about that, Ingmar, was that I said, look, during all of this, first of all, we have to disassociate working from home with working during pandemic, because they're two completely different things, right? Work from home is much more of a cultural thing, a structural thing, you know, an accepted norm, whereas working during pandemic, where, you know, people had the laptops on the knee on the sofa because they had no home office, and, you know, looking in you guys now, you've got like great setups that obviously, you know, the listeners can't see, but I can see where you guys are working from. Lots of people didn't have that, right? Suddenly it's like, you know, you're working during a pandemic, you know, you've got kids running everywhere, you've got dogs and cats and elephants and monkeys and God knows what else all in your workspace. But the reality is that work from home doesn't look like that, right? Work from home looks much more like a thing that you do that's been agreed by your company, which has much more structure, right? Much more control. And then I went on to say, look, you know, we have to make sure that we don't then further conflate remote work with working from home, right? Because, you know, I said working from home is remote work, but not all remote work is work from home. Exactly. And by that, yeah. I mean, if you think about what I did for 20 years in supporting large construction projects, that was all remote work. You know, if you're working on building an oil refinery in Angola or you're building an airport in Qatar, you know, it's remote work. You know, 77,000 people a day on a site building something is all remote work. It still has IT requirements, but it's not work from home. So my point was, each of these has different characteristics. And even in with work from home, as we come through into this next normal, I think we'll see, you know, roles and people and organizations that are perfectly happy with permanent work from home, where it works for the employer and the employee. I think we'll mm-hmm. then see more of a structured work from home that says, you know, well, maybe you do 2 days a week at home, which helps to lower the cost in general to a company. From a facility perspective, also lowers any risk of transference of any of the disease or whatever happens next. And then I think there'll be an ad hoc work from home where you decide, hey, you know, maybe this Tuesday I have somebody coming to look at the heating system, or, you know, I have somebody coming to do whatever in the house. I'm going to work from home that day. So that's what I was trying to paint the picture, that, you know, we shouldn't associate working during the pandemic with any normal work from home. They have some characteristics technically that are similar. But I think as we come out of that, those things will look very different as it stabilizes and becomes more mature.
Yeah, and I think that's also, there's a big culture change as a result of the pandemic. And I guess, it allows me to switch gears a bit as well. I guess another maybe not so obvious change that's caused by the pandemic is the return of digital transformation, as you already mentioned. And Gartner actually mentioned that the brittle nature of many paper and analog processes and the existential need to accelerate digital transformation is a direct result of the pandemic. So I guess it really take a pandemic for organizations to realize this need for, you know, changing the business model. And what is your take on this, let's say, renewed interest? I mean, especially with your, at least one of your new roles is clearly focused on this, right?
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, I have a new phrase at the moment, which I've been using a lot when I talk about things. I mean, whether it's a worldwide thing or whether it's you know, more localized or whether it's inside an organization for different reasons, I've now latched onto a phrase that I call significant events, right? So there are significant events, whether that's a merger and acquisition, whether it's a global pandemic or everything in between, that there are certain things that by their very definition require the status quo to be rethought, right? So if you think about, you know, if you think about what happens coming out of COVID, and you think about what happened during it, where, you know, you couldn't buy anything from the supermarket because it was all gone, right? I mean, all of the essentials that we needed were all gone. That puts a strain on the supply chain. And it also asks questions coming out of it to say, how can we actually make sure that that is more efficient next time? That's a bit of a larger an explanation. But, you know, I mean, certainly in the work that I've been doing with Nexbotics, you know, we're seeing lots and lots and lots of interest in what I would consider to be very basic automation, you know, things like invoice processing, you know, quality checking. I mean, anything that you look at that you say, this had lots of humans doing things that are not particularly high value. I think all of those things are a sweet spot for you know what you and I have talked about historically, Ingmar, is kind of RPA and then RPA dot next. And it just feels to me that you know, and again, if you look at Gartner, as I'm sure you study it a lot, they're talking giant numbers for the next couple of years in terms of the growth of the RPA market. And so, you know, I mean, I think anything that has a process and anything that has a multi-step process is absolutely ripe for organizations to look at and say, you know, can we actually employ technology here that will allow us to free up our people to do things that are more impactful for the business, whether that's, you know, working on what a new business model might look like, working on customer engagement in new ways. You know, I think those things at the lower levels of process just seem to me to be low-hanging fruit for efficiency gains. So, you know, if you put that in digital transformation, absolutely I would. You know, everything that we read, and again, I'm sure you do it a lot, is talking about, you know, by 2024, this is going to go literally exponential from a growth perspective in terms of year-on-year growth and market size in general. So I think it's somewhere in the region of 2 billion this year, then it's going to jump up, significantly over the next few years. But I think what's interesting in that, guys, and you know, maybe one observation, is that a lot of the analyst groups are suggesting that the demand for these things will come outside of IT. And I think that's a trend that we've seen, you know, whether that was in consumerization in the larger sense, or, you know, some of the things that I was excited about from the Citrix point of view, which was obviously after the acquisition of Sappho, the low-code, no-code approach, being able to put these kinds of tools into the hands of the people that understand the business processes. I just see that growing faster and faster and faster and faster, you know, and I think it was something I read recently, I think it was a Gartner thing, that they said by 2024, half of new RPA clients will come from business buyers who are outside the IT organization. And I incredible trend.
Yeah, and I think even in looking at IT budgets, that even now half of the budget is you know spent by IT, but the rest is by the business, and that's changing rapidly. Especially obviously you know due to the pandemic, but also I guess it's just a changing nature of moving to SaaS services and cloud services that you don't really need an IT organization, or at least that the role of the IT organization is changing. But what I like that you mentioned RPA, because obviously that's, you know, it's a fast growing market. It's maybe it's a little bit hyped, and you know you and I had some conversations on that as well. But what I really liked is that like one of the RPA industry leaders, Blue Prism, let's just say they're one of the industry leaders. They described an RPA agent as a digital worker that collaborates with humans, or you know digital workers are highly connected enterprise resources that just like human need to be able to learn and adapt. And therefore, now they're using, you know, narrow AI or just AI to mimic humans' ability to read, understand, and judge. I guess for a lot of people, that sounds very scary. I mean, are robots taking over humanity? I mean, you just said, like, you know, they're more efficient, so we can do it more efficient. I guess, is it a false sense of like reality that people, robots are taking over humanity and that people should fear for their jobs with RPA?
No, I mean, this is the conversation we have all the time, right? You know, how many jobs will be displaced? And I always like to ask how many jobs will be created by the upsides of these things, right? And nobody ever wants to answer that because everybody tends to want to look at the impact of software and technologies and particularly robots in this case. I mean, look, the way I would talk about the concepts of this RPA that we're focused on here is really about augmentation, right? I mean, if you pare it down, you know, right the way from AI down to artificial narrow intelligence, down to machine learning, you know, down to software bots. In my mind, it's relatively simple, right? You have unattended and attended bots underneath them, and that's kind of the two big classifications of what we're talking about. The unattended ones, okay, you know, they do relatively straightforward things. Take this, do this, do that, right? And again, if you think about that from having to have a human do that, which is basically just, you know, data handling on multiple screens, it's not particularly a great use of a human brain, in my opinion. You know, the attended bots obviously can only do a certain thing to your point, Ingmar, about, you know, trying to rationalize what bots can do versus what humans can do. you know, there are certain things where the bots will exceed the capability of what they understand and therefore have to pass that off to a human in terms of an attended thing. The big question there, and this was one we kicked around in Citrix quite a bit, was, you know, what's the path from unattended to attended, or the other way around, right? So if you think about it and you say, well, if I have a very, very simple set of rules and a very simple set of conditions, my unattended bot is pretty good at doing what it does. If I have an attended bot that has to have human interaction, at what point does the system learn enough to say, actually, I've done this so many times now and handed it off and got this result back that now I can actually onboard that as part of the, you know, the unattended bot and almost like training the model, if you will. And actually, I can take more of that. So I think there's a point where you say, okay, well, does that go into one of these Orwellian worlds of like the systems will take over? I just can't see it, honestly. I mean, I think there'll always be, and the, you know, the example I like to give is within aviation, right? As you guys know, I'm a bit of an aviation geek as well. Every commercial airliner, well, I say every, the majority of commercial airliners is entirely capable of taking off, flying and landing on its own. And yet you've got 2, 3, 4, whatever it is, extremely well-trained crew sat behind that door just in case something goes wrong. So I tend to think of an aircraft as like a giant attended bot. So if you think about that, we're already seeing that, right? But, and again, pre-COVID, aviation, global aviation was growing at a significant rate, right? So it's kind of like, you know, I think you have to balance these things, and there will be absolutely no doubt that some of the more laborious jobs like data entry and manual processing, of course, they will disappear in the same way that, you know, some jobs disappeared with automation of motor car factories and so on. So I think we'll always see those kinds of trends.
Yeah, so
I like your analogy of aviation, because I guess your example of airplanes being literally an RPA and attendant bot with and pilot sitting behind there. It also shows the brittle nature of RPAs in itself and the changing role of IT, because if you look at the 77 Max, I guess that's a great example where if you give too much control or wrongly design an RPA or process automation in general, you know, you always need to correct. You always need people who can, you know, understand what's happening. Why are things happening the way they are, and where do we need to change? But go ahead, Johan.
Yeah, so we're not replacing humans with robots, but simply taking the robot out of the human, which is a really good thing, I guess, because, you know, you don't want to do a lot of iterative things and get bored in your job. Change is simply the only constant. So when talking about change, RPA, and how organizations and specifically IT should... or what they should be focusing on in the next couple of years. And let's talk short and long term. How should organizations focus on RPA in the time ahead?
Yeah, so I mean, I think from an IT perspective, I think, you know, like I mean, we've seen this in different trends as well. I mean, I think IT generally are getting better at being a business enabler. You know, if you think historically that really wasn't the case, but I think it's getting a lot better. You know, I think IT being the enabler of RPA from the point of view of needing to understand the conditions within the RPA itself and in terms of, you know, numbers of systems and transactions, I think that's a really interesting one as to like who actually owns that, right? I mean, is it IT that own the correct operation of the robot, or is it the people who actually implement it who may not be IT, or is it both? So I think that's a really interesting question about, you know, who has responsibility for something that is truly fully automated. And that's a really interesting question, you know, because, you know, like anything, I mean, these automations work great when all the systems work in harmony, you know, but the failure rates of those are something that I would be a little bit concerned about if it's not implemented in the right way. So, you know, I think short term, there's no doubt in my mind that people are going to start looking for savings everywhere, right? Whether those savings are related to elimination of staff, or whether those savings are related to, you know, maybe invoice processing is a good one, in sort of an indirect savings perspective. So I think all of those things from you know, business and IT perspective are going to be more important. Longer term, to me, it's going to be really interesting when we start to get questions around, like, how do you actually secure these things is one, right? Because nobody really talks about the security elements within RPA. You know, how do we get visibility into what these things are doing? You know, how do we actually create automation experts, right? Because they don't really exist today. I mean, there are, if you think about it historically, there were people who existed to do things like extract, transform, and load for moving data either by batch or by other processes between different systems. But that's not really what we're talking about here. I think the notion of having automation experts is going to be really interesting. And I see it as a huge growth area. You know, and actually, one of the things that I think will be really interesting is to see whether traditional developers and the ones who are, you know, working on systems that are either no longer required or kind of being sunsetted, you know, do they reskill to becoming new types of developers, or do they actually move into be automation experts because, you know, they know a little bit about the business process, they know a lot about the underlying technologies, and there's this gap that says, you know, how do I actually do these things? How do I implement them? So, you know, I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether the citizen developers and the citizen integrators really come from the business or whether they come from the traditional IT world, or whether in some cases they kind of meet in the middle. But I think like all these trends, Johan, you know, it'll be very hard for IT not to be involved with these, but it would be very easy for them to not to want to get into the levels of detail that I think they're going to need to understand how the value of these things really, really occurs in the business context.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of our listeners, this is there's a huge opportunity for them to learn and maybe even, you know, merge into this new role or transition into this this new role. So before we're going to wrap up this recording, I think most of people in EUC should know you by now, but in case they don't, or they want to know more about your current ventures, where can they find you?
Well, usually on Twitter, so it's at Reilly USA, which is R-E-I-L-L-Y-U-S-A. I find myself on there more than I probably should, but
which we enjoy, dude.
Yeah, thanks, man. No, it'll be a combination of, as you said, guys, jet ski photos and some random thoughts on technology. But you know, you'll see a lot more from Nexbotics. It's kind of early for us, but you know, there's some good traction, and we've got some really good partnerships coming together with some of the bigger RPA companies as well, which is great for us. You know, our goal there really is to kind of shake this market up a little bit by focusing on how to do this in the fastest possible way. I mean, we've set ourselves some targets internally to get, you know, 14 days to get in the first RPA implementations done within the Nexbotics customers, which is, you know, pretty big shooting for the moon. And you know, we've got a great team and a great set of founders there. So hopefully, you know, you'll see more about that. And, you know, who knows what comes next?
Well, I'll surely be closing you, following you closely, as I'm looking forward and reading more of your tweets, and especially around Nexbotics and all the other ventures you might be working on.
Absolutely, and thanks for being so accessible as both a technology leader as and a community friend, I would say.
Oh, it's my pleasure, guys. Like I said, you know, this is a wonderful industry that we're in, and we're all very. Very privileged to be in it and to be able to help each other out. So it's great to spend some time with you guys this morning, and wish you all the best as you carry on blazing the trails.
Thanks, Christian. Cool. So thank you all for listening. We hope you enjoyed this snack as much as we did, as we tried to serve you the right amount of EUC for your appetite. If you have anything you want to add, hear, or just want to stay in touch, reach out to us on our social channels or by email on podcast@eucdigest.com. Cheers.
This podcast is brought to you by iGel. iGel offers the next generation edge operating system designed for simple, secure, and high performance access to virtual desktops and cloud workspaces. Easy to implement and straightforward to operate.